everybody. State Government Finance Committee will come to order February 18th, 12:30. First item on the agenda is an invited guest from the Department of Administration, the State Demographer's Office. And the State Demographer is Susan Brower. And I invited her to come because on the first request for information from all of our accounts, many of the accounts talked about the people that they were serving across the state, the customers, the citizens of Minnesota. And several suggested that that group of people who they were serving were changing. And this was not the Minnesota, today's Minnesota was not the Minnesota of 20 years ago, or 50 years ago, or 100 years ago. And since our budget is moving forward, we should, I thought that we should get an idea of who Minnesotans are today and the trends moving forward for those Minnesotans. Population shifts, state agency personnel located across the state, and so forth. Ms. Brower came at my request to my office, and we talked about several presentations that she had made to various groups across the state and looked at what the committee was looking at. And so Ms. Brower is going to tell us today what Minnesotans are like in 2013, or who are Minnesotans in 2013. Perhaps not put value judgments on them, but just who they are.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Susan Brower. I'm the State Demographer, and I work in the Department of Administration. Thank you. The current demographics of our state have us positioned at the edge of some pretty major changes. This is true of Minnesota, as it is for the U.S. overall, but we're in the midst of a range of social, economic, demographic changes that will impact the way that we as state government deliver services going forward. So today I'm going to first present information about our changing demographics, and then I'll report on the two places that Minnesotans spend most of their time, at work and with their families or in their homes. And in particular, I'll describe what the most recent data say about our work and family lives. And finally, I'll conclude with a brief look at what the state government workforce looks like and how they're related to those broader demographic trends in the state. This is a recent snapshot from the 2010 census of where Minnesotans live across the state. Each of the black dots on this map represents 100 Minnesota residents. And you can see there's the concentration in the Twin Cities metro area and a scattering, of course, of cities and townships across the state. In 2010, just over half of our residents lived in the 7-county Twin Cities metro area. Much of the growth in the state in the past decade between 2000 and 2010 happened in the Twin Cities region, particularly in the exurban counties of the Twin Cities. The darkest grays, let's not do automatic updates just now. There we go. The darkest grays in this on this map here shows the areas that had the most population gain. Mm-hmm. The very darkest had 50% more, 50% or more population gain over the decade, and the red areas in the map show the largest losses, 50% or more. The gold areas that you see in the southwest area of the state, in the southern part of the state, that's showing general population loss in those areas over the course of the decade. This is a continuation of a longer-term trend in our rural areas that we've been experiencing for many decades. This is brought about when the younger generation moves toward the urban areas for schooling, for employment, and then there aren't as many younger folks in those rural areas to have their own families. So we're seeing that population loss and aging in some of those areas of the state as we have in the past. A new trend that we're seeing in terms of our regional growth around the state is that those very rapidly growing exurban areas that we saw over the course of the decade grew very, very quickly, have really slowed since 2001. You can see that at the beginning of the decade, those exurban areas, including Chisago, Carver, Asante, Scott, Sherburne, and Wright counties, were growing very, very rapidly. After the recession, after the housing boom and bust, that growth slowed so that now those exurban areas in the last few years have been growing roughly the same rate as the urban areas. And this is a new trend that we haven't seen in our past. This is something that we're watching closely to see if that high pattern of growth of exurban areas will continue in the future, or if the whole state will be growing roughly at the same rate as it is over the last couple of years. There's reasons to think that the growth rates may stay low like this across the state, or more even, I should say, across the state. And so it's something that we're just keeping our eye on. Minnesotans in general like their home state, and it shows up in the data. A high percentage of people who were born here in Minnesota remain here. An additional roughly 30% were not deterred by our cold weathers. We have 7% of our population coming from a country from outside the U.S. and about a quarter coming from other states. How does this compare to other states? Well, we do fairly well in hanging on to our Minnesota-born residents. We rank 12th among the states in the highest percentage of residents who live where they are born. One of the major demographic trends in the state, of course, in the past couple of decades in particular, has been our increasing diversity. Since 1990 in particular, the state has been becoming more diverse. In 2011, 17% of our state's residents were people of color. In the Twin Cities area, that's 25%. It's still less diverse than the nation overall, but it's been increasing at much the same rate as the nation. This is a trend that we can anticipate to continue going forward, regardless of what happens with international immigration. And that's because those who are in the prime ages to begin families, to have children, are increasingly diverse. So going forward, we know that their children will also be increasingly diverse. So this trend is anticipated to continue into the foreseeable future. Today, 83% of Minnesotans are white. Nearly one in five are people of color, that's 17%. And that's made up of nearly equal parts of people who are black or African American, Latino, or Asian. A smaller proportion of our residents identify with more than one race, or are American Indian or Native American. And part of what's driving that diversity, not all of it, but part of it, is an increase in international immigration to the state in the last 20 years. Our immigration patterns have been changing the state in some significant ways. In the past, our newest Minnesotans came largely from Europe. And you can see in this graph here that blue bar represents the proportion of the foreign-born that come from a European country. And you can see with each successive decade that proportion's shrinking, so that now just a small minority of our foreign-born population is from Europe. And increasingly over time, our residents are coming from all across the globe. The red portion shows our foreign-born population from Asia. The darker gray is from Latin America, largely from Mexico. The lightest gray color are our residents from Africa. And the yellow portion, those residents come from largely Canada. This picture changes who we are as a state, not only racially and ethnically, but also culturally, religiously, and in terms of our social organizations. If we look at Minnesotans by age and race, we see that the younger Minnesotans are more diverse than the older Minnesotans. This is a graph showing five-year age groups going off to the side, and the gray portion is the non-Hispanic white population. The yellow portion of those bars are the populations of color. And if you think about this graph as an escalator, so that every 5 years people are moving up one position in that graph, again, five more years, you can see that increasingly over time, we'll have a more diverse population moving up into those working ages, moving into positions of leadership and so forth in those prime ages. The red bar on this graph is showing the 65-year-old line, which is the classic retirement age. And you can see the bulge just below that are the baby boomers, who are largely white non-Hispanic. As those, as that group moves up over that line on the escalator, increasingly our workforce will become more and more diverse. Because that baby boom generation is so large relative to the other generations, those before it and those after it, the aging trend will be upon us very rapidly. It will be of a magnitude that we haven't experienced in the history in our state. I'm sorry, here we go. This is showing the increase in the older adult population, and it's been pretty constant over the last several decades. But in this decade and next, we will add more people to that 65-plus age group than we have in the last five decades combined. So it's going to be a very, very rapid change as those baby boomers move up over that 65-year-old age mark. This trend will shape our communities, our institutions, our public budgets, and by boomers' absences in our workplaces, work, too, will be transformed in profound ways in the decades to come. So I'd like to shift now to talk about work, what Minnesotans' relationship to work is. This is one of the places where they spend the bulk of their time, of course. And looking at the data from different angles, it's hard to see that Minnesotans are not hard workers. In other words, Minnesotans are very hard workers. We have very high labor force participation. We have high employment relative to other states. This includes people who are both in the labor force and those who are looking for work. Three-quarters of all our working age population is employed. And that puts Minnesota at the fourth highest among states in terms of the proportion of all adults who are employed. Not only do a high percentage of our residents choose to work and participate in the labor force, a large proportion find employment, and we also have a large proportion of workers who work full-time and part-time. So there's just a tremendous amount of data that points to the fact that Minnesotans are engaged in the workplace, in their workplaces. The fact that we're hard workers also comes through when we look at the percentage of Minnesotans who hold multiple jobs. 8% of our workers hold more than one job. This is a percentage that's been declining over time. About 15 years ago, it was about 11% of workers. So this share has been shrinking. And along with many of our Midwestern neighbors that we see here, Minnesota is among the states with the highest percent of employed workers who have more than one job. There's been some research that indicates what produces this pattern. The states with the highest percentage of multiple job holders are also the agricultural states, and those with cold weather in particular. So a part of what's driving this geographic patterning are farm workers who are holding multiple jobs across the seasons. So we've looked at Minnesota residents as increasingly diverse and as aging as a whole, and we've looked at some indicators of our work lives. I'd like to consider now how we spend our non-working hours, what our families look like today in 2013. Perhaps not surprisingly, the vast majority of us live in households with our families, people that we're related to either by blood or by marriage. That's 65% of our households. Another large share of our households are people who live alone by themselves, 29%. And looking forward, we project that the household types that will grow the most will be those older adults living alone and also older couples living, just two people in a couple in a household. And this is driven by that aging trend again. Right now, half of Minnesota's 2 million households contain married couples. That's about 45% of those married couples have children under the age of 18. Another large proportion of our family households are female-headed households. This group, along with individuals who live alone, has been increasing over time, particularly over the last half century, over a long course of time. And this, of course, is part of a larger social trend. What many of us call traditional family forms are becoming less common, particularly among our older generations. So we can see increasingly female-headed households, individuals living alone, and a rise in unmarried couple households. Still a relatively small share when you look at the whole, but it is a share that's increasing. Let's turn and look now how the home lives of our youngest and perhaps our cutest residents are, how they're doing, children living in Minnesota. About 25%, a quarter of our children in Minnesota are people of color. The majority of the children in our state live with their parents who are married. Their parents may be they're married, perhaps they're not their biological parents, but the majority of children are living with a married couple who are acting as their parents. That may not be surprising to you. The 16% of single-parent families in terms of the children who are in these types of homes may not be surprising. But what is surprising to some folks is that 30% of children born in Minnesota in 2011 were born to unmarried mothers. This is just part of this larger social trend that we're seeing where marriage doesn't necessarily come before childbearing. This is true across the U.S., and we're seeing it in our families here in Minnesota as well, particularly when we're looking at childbirth. Family income for these children varies greatly, particularly it varies with the type of family that children are living in. There's a huge range of median incomes for children. Those living in two-parent families have about a $90,000 median income compared to about $25,000 for children living in single female-headed families. About 15% of our children in 2011 lived in poverty. That is a number that's been increasing over time but is relatively low compared to other states. So we looked earlier at where Minnesotans live. This is our map of our population again in 2010. I want to turn now and look to what the state government workforce looks like. You can see that the highest concentration of workers, of course, are in Ramsey County. There's about 14,000 state government workers in Minnesota. But I think what is particularly surprising, maybe, is just how distributed state workers are across the state. Every single county but one contains at least one state worker. And the concentrations in greater Minnesota of state workers tend to be workers who are in DHS, in corrections, some in MnDOT, but most of the Twin Cities Metro contains this executive branch of the workforce, which is what we're seeing right here, the executive branch minus MnSKU. You may have noticed by this point in my presentation that I am not Tom Gillespie. My presence here today, my presence here today is one indication of the changes that we've begun to see in state government, and that is namely the retirement, the baby boomers reaching that age of retirement. And this is another one of those escalator graphs looking at the age distribution of our state government workers. Right now, the median age of our retirement, the average age of retirement, is 61 years old. And you can see that bulge there just right below, just that high concentration of state workers in the 50s to 60s. The changes that we anticipate that we'll see going forward will pose challenges, certainly to staffing, just by the sheer number of replacements that we'll be looking at going forward. But it also represents a number of opportunities to be mindful and deliberate in choosing our next generation of workers. If we look at some of the larger agencies that are the purview of this committee here, we see that there's quite a range in the proportion of workers that are set to retire over the next 5 to 10 years. My home agency, the Department of Administration in particular, tops the list with 42% of its workers who are currently 55 plus. Partly because of our age structure, our state workforce is somewhat less diverse than the working age population in Minnesota and in the Twin Cities overall, and you can see those numbers that's there. It mirrors the population largely, but because we have so many older workers who are in that baby boom generation that's largely white, non-Hispanic, it's slightly less diverse than the population overall. So going forward, Minnesota will continue to become more diverse, racially, ethnically, culturally, and in our family formations. We will be aging rapidly as a whole over the next 2 decades. This will impact our economy, our social, and our work organizations. The state government is no different than the private workplaces right now that are poised on the edge of these massive retirements of the baby boomers. In some ways, this will pose challenges for us to recruit and retain replacement talent, but it also provides big opportunities, as I said, for some of the rapid changes that we may want to see developed in our workplace. And this concludes my prepared remarks. I'd be happy to take questions if there are any. Madam Chair, if there's
any. I did. Ms. Brower, can you tell us what county does not have one state employee?
I believe it's Red Lake County. It's marked with a zero on the map. In the northwestern part of the state.
Representative Pan, how did you allow that to happen?
I needed, Representative Murphy, I needed to leave something for you to do. Clearly an amendment, for the bill that assigns someone to Red Lake County. Who is the legislator there? Purcell? No. Or not?
Would it be Erickson?
Yeah. When we look at these data, we look at a particular point in time. So it may be now that there are many workers there. No. Likely not, but it's looking specifically at July 1.
What? Ms. Brower, we don't mind new goals either.
You didn't live in that county.
The other map that...
he doesn't live there.
I was surprised about was where the yellow was at the top, and the people came from other places, and the yellow represented people from Canada that came to Minnesota.
Yeah.
They came down to shop and then they stayed, or?
That's right. These are perhaps our only immigrants who came here for the weather. I don't think the other ones were here for that. I think there's a fair amount of movement upward in the north, up over the border.
Madam Chair, as a matter of geography, though,
Representative Benson,
our neighbors to the south in Mexico are still part of North America.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. Yes, the Mexican population here in Minnesota, which is quite large relative to other populations, are included in Latin America. They could be included in North America, of course, but people tend to like to see it separated out. So that's why we've showed it this way. Thank you.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You noted that the average state worker retires at 61. What is the average retirement age of the private sector worker?
Ms. Brower.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. The average age of the population overall, we've looked at that, and that has been close to 62, so it's somewhat lower. It's been increasing over time, slightly, not as much as people tend to think, but it has been increasing just incrementally over time. So it's just at about that 62-year-old mark, just above the state workforce.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've got the graph that says the proportion of how many folks are at the age of 64 are working. How many actually above 64, above that 65 mark are still working? Either part-time or full-time.
Ms. Brower.
Madam Chair, Representative, are you asking specifically for state government or in general?
In general.
I don't have those numbers in front of me, but the numbers do fall off very quickly after 65 in particular. It's a percentage that we've seen increase. It's close to the 20% mark, but I can get you a specific figure. I just don't want to pinpoint it without having it in front of me. But it's a smaller percent. It falls off fairly quickly after 65.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Brower. My question was in regard to the high proportion of Minnesotans work, but the share has declined since 2000. The graph that had the two lines that showed Minnesota at 74.6%. Have you all done a breakout with that relative to the white population in the state of Minnesota and the populations of color?
Ms. Brower.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have looked at that. The employment differences between the white non-Hispanic population and our populations of color are among the largest in the U.S. There are tremendous differences in employment. The lowest employment rates right now are among our African American or black population. Those are in the 60% range, so considerably lower. Our Native Americans as well tend to have a much lower rate of employment, and Asian Americans fall somewhere in the middle.
Representative Dean.
No follow-up.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two quick questions. One I'd like to just follow up on, because Representative Howe had some of the questions that I had, but the one in particular, if we have 61 is the median age for retired state workers, do they then, and in your data, do you know if they would seek part-time income after that or a second career? Because at 61 with 19 years of service, the math doesn't work out that you would live on a PERA or a MSRS pension at that point.
Ms. Brower.
Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I don't have the answer to that. There may be some MMB folks in the room that have that information that I can check with them and get back to you.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I was just kind of curious on that because it would seem that in theory someone might start working for the state at age 41 and retire at 61. Again, these are median averages and stuff, so you've got folks who have much more service and folks who have much less service. Just kind of curious about that. And then the other question that I have has to do with, in our packet, it's on page 8, and it would be the first slide. I noticed there are a few more slides that were in your presentation that were actually in our packet, so I'm just going to kind of help guide you into that. And it's our packet, page 8. And the top, it says Profiles of Minnesota Children. And then it talks about family income. And then it talks about married couples. I just am looking for a slight clarification in the data at the $90,300 for the median average married couple income versus $29,686 for a single mother family. Is that all household income or two working parents?
Ms. Brower.
Madam Chair, Representative. That is for the whole household income. So, yes, the married couple families tend to be larger than the single parent families where there may be one or two children and a mother.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. And so children working part-time while they're going to school, some of those kinds of things would be factored into that income or a second income outside of the primary wage earner, mom, pop, that kind of thing.
Ms. Brower.
Madam Chair. Yes, that's right.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, looking at the data, does this break it down by W-2 employees or 1099s, or is it cumulative?
Ms. Brower.
Madam Chair, are you looking specifically at one graph where you're... I'm sorry, I'm not understanding the question.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you. When you look at the workforce and you look at these data, does this only include those that take a W-2, or how about the home-based workers?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brower.
Thank you. This includes self-employment, any kind of employment, including farm employment, and those who are employees who would file a W-2.
Representative Kreshaw.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So just for clarification, so if I am a person that consults or does contracted work and receive a 1099, that would be in here and I'd be considered as employed.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brower.
That's right. These data come from the Census Bureau where people are asked if they're employed in any capacity. So it can be self-employment, home employment for an employer across the board.
Thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brower, I'm just wondering, one of your conclusions says that the population will continue to be concentrated in the metro area. Exurban growth may continue to be slow. I'm just wondering if you looked at population growth within the suburbs. I'm wondering if the inner ring suburb, you know, the core city, the inner ring suburb, second and third ring suburbs, exurban areas, how it compares among those areas. It's a little hard to tell on the map with all the little squares exactly where that's focused.
Ms. Brower.
Madam Chair, Representative. The pattern that's emerged since the recession, since the housing crisis, is very different than the pattern that we've seen for decades before. So what's happened when we look over the course of the decade is this very rapid growth in general in those exurban areas and actual population declines in the suburban areas, in those inner ring suburbs. But what we're watching so closely going forward is to see if the pattern of growth that's been changed by the recession will continue going forward. And that would speak to a new pattern of growth wherein the suburbs likely would be the more, they would grow faster than they had in the past. The urban counties would grow faster than they had in the past. And so that's what we're watching going forward. But if we look at the course of the whole decade, those suburban areas largely were the places where we saw population loss, and the exurban saw the very high areas of growth.
Any other questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is more of a comment, I guess. I realize you're not Tom Gillespie, because we didn't hear his joke that he normally tells when he gives his presentation, that we're, our population is aging 1 year at a time.
You don't have to adopt that.
No changes there.
Any other comments? Well, thank you, Ms. Brower. You hit it right on the head, and we can use this as we contemplate the budget and where the budget's going, and we now know we have to look at up at Red Lake for a state employee. We know that state employees are retiring throughout Minnesota. They're not necessarily staying in Ramsey County, even though they worked in Ramsey County all their lives. They kind of go out to the lake country in many cases, and or they return home to the homestead or become walkers in the woods or birders or something like that. And so we know that the retirement population is certainly shifting in the state, too. But you complied with the request of who were the Minnesotans and how the Minnesota is changing, and there's certainly a lot to think about with this aging population so quick, and our coming workforce. So we have to think about that as we're going along and settling up our budgets. Thank you so much for coming. The first account on our agenda today is the overview and review of the governor's recommendations for the Office of Administrative Hearings. Judge Krause.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Members of the committee, thank you.
Good afternoon.
My name is Ray Krause, and I am the Chief Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings. And today I'd like to, since there's a number of members who are new to Office of Administrative Hearings, give a very brief overview of what we do and how we're funded generally, because it's unlike many other state agencies. And then I will get into the budget recommendations for the from the governor's office. Excuse me. Well, first of all, the Office of Administrative Hearings is an executive branch court. We are not part of the judicial branch. We provide due process hearings and mediations for citizens of the state of Minnesota. Most of the cases that we do are citizens appealing from an action of a state agency. We also provide hearing services and mediation services to cities, townships, and counties on a contract basis. In addition to hearings, the Office of Administrative Hearings is responsible for the review of legality of most agency proposed rulemaking. We have three different divisions within the Office of Administrative Hearings. The first I'd like to address is the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Group. That unit is responsible for managing the process of annexations, detachments, as well as the creation and dissolution of cities and townships. And in that division, we have two very excellent staff persons, and our one of our assistant chief judges acts as the director of this unit. The boundary adjustment unit is funded through an appropriation from the general fund, $254,000 per biennium, and it is really a very small unit, but a very efficient unit. They have dozens and dozens of annexations or dissolutions or detachments in various municipalities that they have to work through every year. The office on the administrative law side also hears those hearings when they come up. The second division I'd like to address is the workers' compensation division. That's the largest of our three divisions. We have 23 full-time judges plus an assistant chief judge. Currently, we have two vacancies. This division handles all the workers' compensation cases for the state, and it's funded through an appropriation from the Special Compensation Fund, so there's no general fund appropriation for this unit. It's entirely funded out of the Special Compensation Fund. Workers' Comp Division is has been at the same budget level for a number of years. We've been able, through a number of efficiency moves, to stay at that level, and this year the governor is recommending no changes to the budget for the Workers' Compensation Division. The third division is the Administrative Law Division. The Ad Law Division provides all the other due process hearings and mediations that workers' comp does not. So we handle cases for the Department of Education, for the Department of Natural Resources, for the Public Utilities Commission, just about any state agency that holds a contested case process would go have their hearings held by the Office of Administrative Hearings. In that division, we have 7 full-time judges plus an assistant chief judge, and we have 5 contract judges. We use contract judges for a number of reasons. One is our caseload peaks and valleys periodically, and rather than hire judges and then have to lay them off and then hire them again over time, we use contract judges to even out those peaks and valleys. The second reason is because we hear cases all over the state, and we have to charge our travel time to the agency that we're billing. One of the innovations that we've come up with is having contract judges in various locations around the state, so that they can do those far outstate cases and save the agency the travel time that it would cost for a judge from the Twin Cities to go out to whatever location it might be. So that has also saved a great deal of funding. As I alluded to, the Office of Administrative Hearings Ad Law Division, it bills for its budget. We're much like a law firm in the sense that the agency that hires us to hear its case, we bill that agency on an hourly basis. Our entire budget, with 2 exceptions, is completely through the billing process. We bill at $165 per hour. That's well below market, and it's a price that is set by the Office of Management and Budget, or MMB, and they set that rate that we charge as a break-even point. We do a business plan every year about how many cases we think we're going to have and how much capacity we need to handle those cases, and through a process with MMB, they set that rate. And that rate we have to charge for any case that we hear for any agency, so they're all charged exactly the same. The 2 exceptions for that, so again, with these 2 exceptions, there's no general fund money in the Administrative Law Division either. The 2 exceptions are, first, data practices cases, and their legislation was passed in 2010 that gave us jurisdiction to hear on a fast-track basis issues surrounding the Data Practices Act. when that was passed, since it didn't, that jurisdiction didn't exist prior to then, there was no real idea of how much these cases would cost or how many there would be. And the funding mechanism that was set up by the legislature for that was to have a $1,000 filing fee that the person requesting the data would put up. If that person prevailed, they would get their $1,000 filing fee back, and we would bill the state or local agency that withheld the data improperly. If, on the other hand, the city or the county or the state was the one that prevailed, we would bill at $165 an hour against that $1,000 filing fee, which, again, was kind of guesswork on everyone's part, both the legislature and in our office, because this process never existed before. As it turns out, that type of case is much more complex than the authors thought it was going to be, and it takes more time to handle these cases than we anticipated. And so we have ended up, by the end of this year, with a $40,000 shortfall. And again, by statute, we can't take from one case type to pay for another case type, and we can't charge a different rate. So we're kind of stuck with this $40,000 shortfall. MMB has told us we can't rob Peter to pay Paul, so to speak. So the governor has included in his budget a $36,000 change item to cover most of that shortfall from last year. We're currently working with the authors of the bill from 2010 and the stakeholders who were interested in creating this in the first place to find a better and more viable long-term funding mechanism for this. We think that there are several options. There isn't agreement yet on what the option going forward will be, but we're pretty confident that we'll find a different funding mechanism that would eliminate this problem going forward. At least we're very hopeful.
In 3 weeks' time.
Yes.
Judge?
It's a lot of work in a short time. The second exception where there are some general funds involved is the political campaign practice violation cases. And these cases came to us about 9 years ago, 10 years ago, when before which the county attorneys did these cases. And everyone seems to have agreed that since we've taken them over, that the process has gone very well, very smoothly. Cases are all on our website, so people have now a view of what the answers to some campaign questions are. And the way we bill for that is we bill it, again, the $165 an hour against a $130,000 per biennium appropriation from the campaign fund, political state campaign fund. And that's worked well up until now. So for 10 years, that number has been sufficient. This year we had a significant upturn in cases, really large. It went from last year being 5 cases to 54 cases this year. We came up with a shortfall because the $130,000 was not enough to cover all of those cases. The shortfall is about $60,000. The governor has not put in his budget recommendations a change item to fund that deficit. So it's the same kind of problem as data practices. We have to do the cases, but there's no money against which we can bill. So we have this shortfall that management budget says we can't have. So we're kind of stuck on that one. And I'm not sure why it's not in the governor's office. But proposal, same as data practices. I don't have an answer to that yet, but that's where we are. And so those two are the exceptions in the administrative law. division that end up taking some general fund money. If we get data practices fixed, it shouldn't going forward, but campaign practices may happen again. I don't know. With that, Madam Chair, that's an overview of who we are, what we do, and our budget, and I'm happy to answer any questions you or the members may have.
Okay. Representative Judge Krause, how does one get to be a law judge?
Madam Chair, the process is I am appointed by the governor on a six-year term. Then the judges in both the Workers' Compensation Division and the Administrative Law Division are appointed by me. And they are civil service. They're appointed essentially as any other civil service person would be, with the same rights and all of that. So they're not on terms. They're not subject to election. They are regular civil service employees.
Do they get the same salary? A judge for workers' comp?
Yeah, Madam Chair,
and
yes.
And a judge for administrative law and a judge for municipal boundary adjustment?
Madam Chair, yes. All of the judges, our salaries are set, including mine, by statute. And so the workers' compensation judges, the administrative law judges are all the same salary, and those are set by legislation.
And someone that's interested in this could apply to you then, or to your office?
Yes, Madam Chair. As a matter of fact, we have we will be in the next few weeks, I hope, getting a posting up for the two vacancies we have in the Workers' Compensation Division and taking applications. It goes through the same process as all the other agencies through management budget.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Krause. What is the breakdown of your staff, your staffing? You know, okay. How many people in different
sure.
areas?
Jed Krause.
Madam Chair, Representative, in the Administrative Law Division, we have seven judges, assistant chief judge, and five contract judges. With those judges, we have staffing of about nine staffers, legal secretaries, a scheduler, those kinds of docket clerk, those kinds of things. The Workers' Compensation Division, we have 23 full-time judges plus the two vacancies. We have two staff attorneys, or three staff attorneys, I'm sorry, and we have about 26, I think, staff, docket clerks, schedulers, secretaries, legal secretaries, and our HR function.
25
and two, excuse me, Madam Chair, and two people in the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Group. I shouldn't forget them.
And 25 judges in Workers' Comp?
It's 23 at the moment with two vacancies, right. Yes.
Madam and Chair. That's and they're not all in one place.
Madam Chair, we have an office in Duluth, and we have two judges in that office in Duluth. We also have one of our contract judges for the Administrative Law Division up in our Duluth office.
And the municipal boundary people, where are they located?
They're here, Madam Chair, in our office in the Stassen building. There's just the two.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have two questions. Chief Judge Krause, do any of the cases ever get referred to the Judicial Department? Do they come out of your...
Madam Chair, Representative...
Judge Krause.
Yes, our cases... there's several ways that happens. In the Administrative Law Division, any appeal from a case over which we have final decision-making authority would go to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Okay. Many of the kinds of decisions we do are recommended decisions, and the final decision goes then to the commissioner of whatever agency it is. For example, in a daycare license case, we make a recommended decision to the commissioner of DHS. The commissioner makes the final decision, and then that is appealable to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So there's an extra step in some of our kinds of cases. Workers' compensation cases are appealed to another executive branch court, which is the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. And those, if you appeal beyond that, goes to the Minnesota Supreme Court.
Okay. Thank you. And the second question, thank you. In the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Unit, do they ever deal with cases on highway annexed, land annexed by whoever, or school land purchase, any disputes in that arena? I mean, which is very, I think it's kind of close to cases that you'd normally deal with on municipal boundaries. So I'm curious, what's the breadth of that reach?
Judge Krause.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, we don't do any of those kinds of cases. The jurisdiction for the MVA unit is limited to cities annexing part or all of a township, dissolution of cities, creation of cities, consolidation of cities, or detachments from a city to a township. And those are the only kinds of things we have authority to deal with.
Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Krause, good to see you. Thanks for being before the committee. First, let me just say I see in your, as part of the agency profile, I really want to congratulate you in terms of your docket here. I see that the time for issuing a written opinion after closure of the record is down, and down substantially. As you know, in the district court levels, that's a really big issue with crowded dockets. So whatever you're doing, it's obviously a big success. So I think that's really great.
Thank you.
I think taxpayers should know that and appreciate that. That's very important, I think, to litigants. A question about what you just mentioned about the budget. So the governor is recommending $36,000 to cover for your data practices loss, so to speak, but not the $60,000 that you've apparently incurred in a shortfall for the campaign finance cases. So assuming that that is what this committee does, just hypothetically, how would you absorb the $60,000? What will be the next step? I'm not so much talking specifically about, but generally speaking, what will you do if you don't get the $60,000?
Judge Krause.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, darn good question. I don't have a good answer to that. I suspect if it doesn't get resolved at the legislative level, we'll go back to MMB and say, tell us what to do, because statutorily we're obligated to do the cases, and yet we're statutorily obligated not to take funds from different case types to pay for that. We don't have any reserve funds. We have a revolving fund that pays our salaries and rent and whatnot, but that's a revolving fund that just gets the money put back in that we bill, so it's not something we can draw out of again without robbing Peter to pay Paul. So I don't have a good answer for you. I don't know how we're going to absorb that without violating one statute or the other.
Okay.
Representative Simon.
Just one quick administrative question, then a policy question. Do you have rotating law clerks available to the permanent judges or to any of the judges?
Judge Krause.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, we don't at the moment. We have, as I said, in the Workers' Compensation Division, three staff attorneys who do various projects and help the judges, but we don't have law clerks. We have been thinking about doing that. We've had a lot of requests from the law schools to have their people come over and do law clerk clerking for us. We haven't done that yet, but we're thinking that that might be a cost-effective way to, again, keep those turnaround times for decisions low. And so it's something that is on our plan for the next, our strategic plan for the next few years to do that.
Well, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would think you could get some, frankly, some free labor out of it, too. You could get some third-year law students to do it for credit. and you could probably get quite a bit of help. I know a lot of the cases that you tackle are some pretty complex cases, and it would probably really help. I would imagine to have some clerk help, and there are probably some students who would help out for just the credit. I just have one other policy question. Someone just this morning met with me about the idea that's been kicking around here for a while about transferring implied consent jurisdiction to OAH. Do you have a position on that, or are you sort of staying out of that? And from our standpoint as a finance committee, what would that mean for us? What would the funding source be? Would you just, if we were to do that, would you have to bill the Department of Public Safety just like you do any other agency?
Judge Krause.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's an idea that's been around for a long time, and we don't, as the Office of Administrative Hearings, because we're a quasi-judicial function, we don't take policy positions, so we don't have a position that we're for it or against it. If the legislature wants us to do it, we're happy to do it. We think we can do it. We've worked with a number of groups over the years, the Department of Public Safety, the sheriffs, the judicial branch, MAD, SAD, all those groups. There's a coalition looking at this, and we've been working with them to try to figure out how it would work. There is a bill now in to create a pilot project, and that has some funding attached to it. As far as doing it statewide, the conundrum is this. The judicial branch now charges up to $320 filing fee for these cases, and regular district court judges handle these cases. At $320 per case, we think our cost to handle those cases is significantly less than that, and so we could do it for less than $320 per case. The problem is, if we do that and we take the filing fee of $320, the judicial branch loses that, and they are opposed to losing that. And so that's where it's always fallen down, without some other independent funding source that would presumably come from this committee or some other committee. So we think we can do it faster, better, cheaper. Most states have an Office of Administrative Hearings, and in most states, 26 of them, they do implied consent hearings, not through the judicial branch, but through their OAH. So it's a concept that works in many states. Our conundrum has always been how to fund that so the judicial branch doesn't lose its $320 per case. We estimated last time we looked at this that our case per case cost would be about $265, so it's not a lot less, although their cost to do one of these cases in the judicial branch is over $580. So the filing fee doesn't cover it for them, but it would cover it for us.
So Representative Simon, maybe let the cost or part of the money stay with the court and then go up to $475 or something like that. But why would we want to do that? Why would we want to make that change?
Madam Chair, that's why exactly the question I asked in my meeting this morning. So I'm just trying to figure out what the stakeholders think. And I know you're right about the hole in the judicial budget, although it goes both ways. There would be a hole in the budget, but they'd have also less work to do because those IC cases tend to pile up. There are many, many thousands. So,
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chief Judge Krause, my question is in relationship or in relevance to that campaign finance, and you said there's a large increase in the number of cases. Do you have an opinion of what caused that increase, and if there's anything that could be done to maybe minimize that and make it more stable?
And maybe, Judge Krause, if you could think back, is the presidential election year bring more cases?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we do. We get the $130,000 on a biennial basis, and there's generally in the off year not much going on, and so we don't bill much, but we carry it over to the next year, and the second year is always higher than the first, in especially in presidential years. This year, it's been higher than it's ever been by a significant margin, and why that is, I'm not entirely sure. We saw these cases this year. One of the big reasons is there was a very large case against the Secretary of State about the proposed constitutional amendment, and that went to us, and it went back to us two or three times, and so it was a very expensive case in and of itself, just that one. But putting that one aside, the cases this year, and I hate to make a generalization, but there seemed to be a lot more smaller, nastier cases, if you will, that had less substance to them and more venom, if you catch my drift, than we've had in the past. Most of the ones in the past have been more, they don't understand exactly how the rule works, and so we had to interpret it, and once we did, that case type kind of went away because they knew what the answer was. That was what we had from the beginning a lot of, and we're now getting mostly, I can say to my people in my district that so-and-so is under investigation, and there's a lot of that this time that there hasn't been in the past. Not a very precise answer, I'm sorry, but that's all I can draw from it.
So we can say we've got a loss of civility in the political arena. Is that what we're saying? That's just you don't have to answer that. That's just that's what I'm drawing from your answer.
Representative Purcell.
I'll pass, Madam Chair. Thanks.
Representative Freeberg.
You talked a little bit about mediation. I'm just wondering, if there's a variety of mediations that you handle in the different departments, how extensive they tend to get, if they're handled by the judges, or if there are other people, contractors, who can handle that, what the rate is. I'm just sort of looking for a little more information about how that process works in your office.
Madam Chair, Representative.
House.
Thank you. We do mediations in just about every case type that comes at us. We do in workers' compensation, we do hundreds of mediations a year. And our regular workers' comp judges are the ones who do those. They're quite adept at it. We have a very high, it's over 90% success rate when we mediate a case in workers' comp, getting it settled. That really speeds up the process for the injured worker. It also enables us to continue to provide the hearings at the budget we've been at since before I was here. Because there's that many less cases that go to hearing, which take more time and more cost and more judge time. In the administrative law division and municipal boundaries, we do a lot of mediations in special education. Again, it's judges in the administrative law division that are doing that. We're billing that at the same rate we're required to, $165 an hour, as we do anything else. We do mediations in a lot of licensing cases, doctors, chiropractors, nurses, anything that's licensed. We do them in Commerce Department cases. We do some in DNR cases. We have two of our staff attorneys who are trained as mediators and are Rule 114 certified, so we could use those if the need was there. We've only done that once when we had too many mediations for all of our judges to handle, so we had the staff attorneys jump in. That's something that we have more capacity for than we have the need at the moment.
Representative Freiberg?
Okay.
Yep,
thank you.
Representative Bernardi?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you being here today and answering some of our questions, because this is foreign to me. I'm not a lawyer and haven't been involved in that system. Administrative law judge, I just want to get clear if this is what you guys would be involved in, and then what recourse if an agreement hasn't been honored. So administrative law judge, when municipal consent is granted, and is not granted, would you be the people that would become involved in coming up with an agreement between municipality and like a state government office?
Judge Krause.
I'm trying to think, Madam Chair, representative of a case like that. We don't see any cases where it's the a county or a municipality versus the state. It's usually a citizen versus a state agency. Or in the contract cases that we do, we do these kinds of hearings for example, Hennepin County and Ramsey County and a number of cities and counties around the state. But it's usually a citizen appealing a decision made by either a municipality or the state.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you. That helped.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a follow-up to Representative Simons. The first thing that comes to mind in terms of implied consent is DUI. Are those the kinds of cases that you're speaking of?
Yes.
I know this isn't just beginning, and because it's been talked about before in the legislature. The kind of workload workload levels that would represent, what that staffing increase would mean for the Office of Administrative Hearings. Have you given some thought to that?
Judge Krause.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, I think it was now 3 or 4 years ago, there was a bill that had some momentum on this issue, and what we had worked out with the stakeholders in that was we would have we'd have to hire probably 5 staff people, 3 of which were judges, 1 scheduler, 1 docket clerk, and we were going to and these are just the revocation of the license. They're not the DUI itself. That's the criminal charge, and that would still go to district court. We're just talking about the license issue for failure to consent. And so we were going to have two of those in the Twin Cities and 2 outstate and do them by video. And that's one of the reasons the sheriff's offices liked the idea, is their sheriffs don't have to go into district court and sit all day waiting for a judge. We'd have it scheduled, and they could do it right from the sheriff's office as the witness or whatever have you. So it wasn't a huge number of people, but it was an increase in our staff to be able to handle those cases, yes.
Just one follow-up?
One follow-up.
Then looking at that in terms of separating the administrative from the criminal, those efficiencies that you stated earlier were still part of that?
Judge Krause.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's what we were talking about when we were talking about the differences in the cost, yes.
All right. Thank you.
Judge Krause, you talked about the $40,000 deficit and the $60,000 deficit, but could you just very briefly, because we're over time now, but very briefly talk about the change in the MPCA and the sanitary district thing?
Madam Chair, yes. I didn't mention that because it's actually a proposal of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It's not our proposal, but it does affect us.
But you've accepted?
We have agreed to do that, yes, Madam Chair. The concept is within MPCA, they now do the annexations, dissolutions, consolidations, detachments of sanitary districts, just like we do for municipalities. And they sort of stumbled across the fact that we did this and felt that the processes were almost identical and that we could do it better, faster, cheaper. And so they asked if we would agree to take all of that from them, and they would shift funding from the environmental fund to cover the cost of that, which would be ultimately lower than what it's costing them now. Environmental fund to cover the cost of that, which would be ultimately lower than what it's costing them now. So we agreed to do that, that's where that came from.
And is there a bill for that?
I believe the MPCA is putting that before a committee. I don't know, to be honest with you.
Right. And then one more question I had from left over from last year. One of the bills in the final days that passed said that administrative law judges can marry people. And I suspect they can also receive a stipend for that. Does that stipend go into your fund, or does that stipend remain with the individual law judge? And if so, do you set the amount of the stipend?
Madam Chair, if there is any stipend to doing that, it would go stay with the judge who's doing it, who would do it on their own time. And we have no policy about setting that one way or the other. It's strictly between the judge, as it is in the judicial branch, between the judge and the individuals getting married.
And do you have any idea how many marriages were performed by your law judges?
I only know of one, Madam Chair, and that was the marriage that caused the bill to be put forth in the first place. It was one of our judges marrying her niece and a gentleman last October. It's the only one that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The second item on our appropriation agenda today is the Office of the Governor and Lieutenant Governor, Ms. Brown. Thank you for coming. We know that there are no recommended changes, but we would like to hear a little overview about your office.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paula Brown. I'm the Director of Operations for the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's Office. I've served in this position since 1999. I'm here today to provide you with some background information about the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's Office budget and to answer any questions you might have. The Governor and Lieutenant Governor...
Excuse me, Ms. Brown. You've served in this position since 1999?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
And your position is what?
Director of Operations, Madam Chair.
For the Governor's Office and Lieutenant Governor's Office.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The Governor and Lieutenant Governor, along with their staff, oversee and lead the executive branch of state government. They represent over 5.2 million Minnesota residents across the state. They develop a state budget every 2 years for consideration by the legislature. They respond to more than 100,000 citizen calls and contacts each year. They appoint commissioners, members of state boards and commissions, and judges, and appoint about 1,300 citizens to 140 various boards and commissions. They also serve the State Executive Council, the State Board of Investment, Land Exchange Board, CAP Board, and the Board of Pardons. The Governor serves as Commander-in-Chief of the Minnesota National Guard, and the Governor is also involved in issuing extradition papers, proclamations, and writs of special election. The office is funded through a direct appropriation from the general fund and the payments made to a special revenue fund that was set up by the legislature a few years ago. Our proposed budget for the office requests same level funding as the current biennium. $6,386,000 from the general fund, $1,440,000 from the special revenue fund, totaling $7,826,000. A few key points I'd like to make. Other than one biennium, the 04-05 biennium, during the past 15-plus years, this budget request is lower than any other governor's office budget this office has had since fiscal year 96-97. The budget allows us to maintain core functions and staffs the office with 38 full-time staff members. We also have an intern program that offers college students and exposure to public policy and government operations, and they assist us in providing services to the citizens of Minnesota. The proposed 38 FTEs compares to a high of 55 FTEs during both the Carlson and Ventura administrations and a high of 48 FTEs during the Pawlenty administration. And finally, about 80% of our budget is spent on personnel costs, with the other 15 to 20% on operating expenses. Madam Chair, members, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the application process for those interns that you have there, college students?
Ms. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have relationships with a number of the colleges across the state, and I know that our communications and constituent services staff work directly with those colleges and their websites and our website, and we have an application process on our website where those students can apply.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up on the Chair's question because that caught me a little by surprise as well. As the Director of Operations, is that a gubernatorial appointment or is that a classified position? Because you would have served for three different governors and three different parties over that 10 to 12 year period of time. I'm just wanting to know, what are you doing right?
She's a survivor. Ms. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative. My position serves at the pleasure of the governor, so I'm in an unclassified position. I have had the honor and privilege of working for all three parties and feel very honored and blessed to be here. Thank you.
Representative Leidiger.
Well, the same thing for me. It really kind of changes the line of questioning because you do have someone who's been there a long time. So I want to kind of ask this question in a little bit different vein, especially when I look at the outcomes that the Office of the Governor supports. You've probably seen changes in that area probably over time. I suspect that it hasn't stayed the same since 1991. But there's one item in there that I want to kind of focus on, and that's the strong and stable families and communities. Has that been a consistent goal over your tenure there across all the governors, or is that something that is new that this governor is focusing on?
Ms. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative, the statewide outcomes, the way that we are presenting them is very different this biennium than previous bienniums. In addition to that, I'm probably, as long as I've been here, I'm still not the best person to ask questions or to answer questions related to state government overall. I know a lot about the internal operations of the governor and lieutenant governor's office, but I don't feel comfortable kind of speaking to that issue.
Well, if I can follow up, because what I really want to know is, what are we doing? You know, what's the governor's priorities here, and what's he doing to enhance that outcome, you know, accomplish that outcome of strong and stable families and communities? And I'm not sure how we're going to get that kind of a question answered, and maybe this is not the right place. I'm not sure. But that's what I'd like to drill down to.
Ms. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative, I appreciate your question. We listed, the governor and lieutenant governor's office chose to list all of the state's outcomes in our budget proposal because we feel we work closely with and influence to some extent all of them. Our agencies, as I understand it, will be speaking directly to each of these outcomes. I think each of the agencies has one or two outcomes that they have tied their budget to, and I presume will be speaking to that in their hearings.
Representative Leidecker.
Yeah, I'll just we'll leave that at that. Thank you.
Any other questions? Do you are you the director of operations for the House too? Also,
Madam Chair, no, just the governor and lieutenant governor's office
at the Capitol.
Yes,
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you went from a staff in the past, I guess, 12 years from, was it 58 you said originally?
55
to then 48 to now 38. So what's had to go away or what's had to give, or has some of that responsibility been assigned in other areas within, you know, state government? If you could just explain that a little bit, because it, you know, I mean, a reduction of staff of nearly 30% has to have a huge, huge impact on what you're able to do.
Madam Director Wood, or Director Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative, it has had, certainly had an impact when we've gone from a high of 55 at the beginning of the Ventura administration to a current number of 38. Five of those positions, I can tell you, came from the governor's residence. We made a number of changes really back in, I believe, 2003 that reduced the kinds of events and activities that were held at the residence and the way we did that work. And so we were able to reduce that number from 10 to 5. In addition to that, we have taken steps in our communications office, in our overall operations to make use of technology that's available, and over the course of the last 10 years or so, we've been able to increase our efficiencies in each of those areas so that each department within the office has trimmed their FTEs by a few in each area.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I can, I just was interested, Representative Leidecker, in what you said there, and I don't know all the places that the current governor's made commitments on strong families and everything, and certainly I think we all share that. I do know there's a number of things going on that he's proposing, education and such, but in this three-ring binder we have, I was reading through this and haven't gotten all the way through it, but reading some of this, and in the Veterans Affairs Department here, it just as one agency anyway, Veterans Affairs supports the following statewide outcomes: Minnesotans are healthy, Minnesotans have education skills needed to achieve their goals, strong and stable families and communities. And I know that's supported, you know, I think around this whole table and by the governor for sure in my interactions with him, and you know, who among us doesn't have a veteran in a family somewhere? So, you know, when we talk about supporting veterans, we talk about supporting all Minnesotans and their families. So, anyway, that's just one place, Representative Leidecker, that I've seen that.
Ms. Brown, we thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you very much.
Members of the committee, our next meeting is Wednesday. This meeting is adjourned.